From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. How good is your memory? Good enough to beat an ape? A chimp named Ayumu has a flash memory that puts humans to shame.
Not only is he reading and understanding the numbers, he's able to remember their exact positions after seeing them flash on a screen for less than a second. Apes consistently get 10 in a row correct, while humans rarely reach 6 before failing.
We speak with a primatologist who says we've really underestimated animal intelligence for years. Then we'll take a trip to Callaway Gardens here in Georgia and learn the history behind the beauty. That's all coming up. First, though, the great cornbread debate continues. Food editor Kathleen Purvis spoke with us earlier this week about the racial divide over this Southern classic.
The African-American culture started to move toward adding a little more sugar to it, going with something that was a little more cake-like, while the white Southerners tended to stay with the yellow corn meal that they were more familiar with that never needed sugar and usually didn't have sugar. And then it developed into two different styles.
So here are your first thoughts.
My name's John Studstill. I've lived all my life in Georgia, grew up in South Georgia, and have eaten cornbread, I suppose, 100 different places. And I never had any sweet cornbread until I went to Publix. They say the formula comes from somewhere up north, I think. I have associated it with a regional divide rather than an ethnic divide.
It's an interesting point. You can call us at 404-500-9457 and give us your thoughts on anything. It doesn't have to be cornbread. You can also tweet us at OST Talk or post on facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. We might feature your comments on the show. Water has made a lot of headlines in the past few years, actually. Severe drought in the West, contaminated water in Flint. Before that, contaminated water in West Virginia. And then last weekend, a power outage knocked out two Atlanta pumping stations, and the city issued a boil water advisory. Right now, Atlanta is focused on preparing for what could be the next water emergency, whatever that is. Joanne Macrina joins me now. She's the commissioner for the city's Department of Watershed Management. Good morning.
Good morning.
So how much water do you oversee? How much water is in our watershed management system?
Well, we serve 1.2 million people, so not just the city of Atlanta, but also other cities and counties.
And we're talking millions of gallons?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Yeah, easily,
yes.
Right? Okay, so when you think about emergencies, I just named a few of them. There was, of course, the West Virginia emergency that knocked out the public water for a really
10 days.
Long time.
Yes.
We've heard a lot about what's happened in Flint. So which of those do you look at and say, okay, we need to learn from this?
With every incident, whether it's in our country or around the world, we want to take lessons from each one.
So if you look at, say, West Virginia, and you were really quick on knowing exactly how long it took the water back to get back on, right? So you probably read a lot about it and studied it?
Of course.
What do we learn? What went wrong? I mean, other than the contamination of the water, the spill of chemicals into the water, what went wrong in terms of the way the government responded?
Well, it's each case is very different.
Yeah.
And I certainly don't want to remark or criticize another utility. I want to look at our own and how well prepared we are should that ever happen to us. And there's always that chance that something very similar could happen in the city of Atlanta, in the metro Atlanta area. So we always want to be prepared. And we are prepared, and we are becoming even more prepared. So we are doing a number of things in the city of Atlanta because, after all, we do take care of 1.2 million people. And that is our charge, our responsibility. So we look at the potential for contamination, the potential for drought, the potential really for anything that could happen. The city of Atlanta, just like most of metro Atlanta, depends on the Chattahoochee River as a water source.
Right. We're landlocked, which is not not usual for a large major city.
Yes, correct. And currently, and this is not unusual, currently we have about 3 days of what we call raw water supply, that is untreated water from the source. And one of our largest and highest priority project right now is our new raw water tunnel and rock quarry that we are turning into our water storage. Our
like new a reservoir. Water,
correct. Now, once we finish that tunnel, we'll be able to fill up that quarry, and that will give us 30 to 90 days of raw water supply.
30 to 90 days.
Yes.
So at this moment, we wouldn't be prepared to outlast, say, a West Virginia tripe in this incident. But the hope is that we will in the future.
That is correct. Yes.
Now, it's also a matter of pipes and the transit system for the water. I mean, that was obviously a lot of the problem in Flint. They're talking about very aging infrastructures. But I was also interested to learn how much water many systems lose because of leaky pipes. What is our pipe situation here?
Those are very good questions. Flint had a very difficult situation, and they're still dealing with it.
Yeah.
We are not in that situation. There were a lot of factors involved in Flint. We have the Chattahoochee River as our water source. They were changing their water source, and there are a number of things that you're supposed to do when you do change the source of your raw water.
I just want to be clear. The reason you mentioned that is because in Flint, they switched from the Detroit water system, which has great water, to the Flint River, and that was the source of the problem. But it was exacerbated by pipes, lead pipes.
Well, that is correct. But there were also other factors
right,
involved.
Right, absolutely.
So in the city of Atlanta, just like all of Metro Atlanta's utilities, the state of Georgia has very strict protocol that we follow. We do have a corrosion prevention program. We make sure that there is an additive in our drinking water that prevents any kind of leaching. We don't have lead pipes, but we do have some lead joints. We test our water hourly. We have to report to the state monthly. And specifically on lead, we have to report out every 3 years.
So these are all things, I should say, that were not in place in Flint. But one thing we've heard a lot about is the fact that many systems don't know where lead pipes are and are not. And part of that is not just the city's systems, right? But it's the pipes that connect from the city systems to a home. Is there any way for the city to know if there's lead pipes existing on private property?
Typically, there is not. Our pipes are made of other types of material.
Yeah. So, in to your mind, what is our biggest challenge? Is it this water reservoir that you're working on right now in terms of expanding it? Is the storage of raw water?
We have both the transmission of raw water and the storage of raw water. And also the storage of finished water. So there's a difference between raw water and finished water. Finished water is treated, and we cannot store finished water for a very long time. We have to keep changing it over. So our lines that bring water from the Chattahoochee River to our system are aging. Our oldest pipe was put in 1893. So we are working right now to replace that aging system with a tunnel. This is a deep rock tunnel. It'll be between 300 to 400 feet deep in granite rock, which we are very fortunate to have granite rock in the metro area. So we will soon place this very old system with a brand new system, which is a tunnel that will last at least 100 years, if not twice that long, and maybe more.
So for Atlantans who are looking at, say, Flint or West Virginia and saying, could that happen here? Your answer is?
We have precautions already in place, and we follow very strict state procedures. But we also are planning for the future and making sure that our future generations are protected and have that raw water supply.
That is Joanne Macrina. She is the commissioner for the city's Department of Watershed Management. Joanne, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Students across the Southeast took part in an underwater robotics competition last weekend. Gray's Reef National Marine Sanctuary hosted that event and created a variety of challenges for the robots to complete. Each team had to build and program an ROV, or remotely operated vehicle, to take on each of those tasks. GPB Savannah's Gabrielle Ware was at that competition, and she brings us this audio postcard.
I'm Ben Bazzelli. I'm from Backworth, Georgia, and I go to Moncler Middle School. We completed the entire mission under the time requirement. We're supposed to complete certain tasks that they put out for us. Like this year, we had these CubeSats, and we had to put them onto on a mat and bring them out of the water.
My name is Michael Ganachuk, and I've been doing robotics for 2 years now. We worked about almost the entire school year, and it was very hard. We did have some difficulties and problems, but we got through it as a team.
My name is Dorothy Shimkevich, and I'm from Carrollton High School. I would definitely say that it's been the center of my high school career. I've kind of realized that I am an engineer in my core, and so that's kind of transferred to what I will be doing in the future, and I'm trying to decide between MIT and Stanford.
Hi, I'm Daniel Kuntz. The most fun thing about working in robotics is putting your heart and soul into building something and spending a ton of time at just perfecting something and seeing it work flawlessly when you put it in the water. We're very persistent about it. We have multiple occasions this year and last year where we've stayed up until midnight to work on things. And we do not stop until something works properly.
This is what I do after school, and I fall asleep sometimes thinking about different things that we have to come up with for ROV.
You'll need a motor on the top to push it down. And these two will push it forwards and backwards.
But the thing is we only had three motors.
You're going to need a motor on the bottom to make it rise.
I'm Ben Armstrong, and I go to Glenn Middle School.
My name's Parth Patel.
He was just giving us advice and tips about how we can make our ROV better in the future.
How long have you guys been working on this?
A week, maybe 2 weeks.
A week?
We started 2 weeks ago, but we kept messing up. We spray painted it before we glued it. And, you know, that didn't work because the glue kind of made it all weird and it all broke. So we had to start over yesterday.
We had a lot of fun.
We had a good laugh. Yeah. It was fun.
Even though we didn't do that well, it was fun and we had a learning experience.
It moved an inch.
It was definitely something I would recommend for other people. My name is Mitchell Kent.
I'm Brandon Perez.
My name is Aiden Hintz.
My name is Susanna Knight.
And we come from the STEM Academy at Bartlett. Yeah. Well, we had a slight complication with our Arduinos. We had two different, they're pretty much microcontrollers, which we program to do certain tasks. And apparently what happened was there was too much power flickering, which can fry the Arduinos, which now we can't be able to work any of these anymore.
So we went ahead and we came today, even though we knew we weren't going to be able to compete. We came to see what we could do different and what we could change.
That's a little taste of the underwater robotics competition from last weekend, hosted by Gray's Reef National Marine Sanctuary, that audio postcard brought by GBB Savannah's Gabrielle Ware. This is On Second Thought. You probably already recognize the name Callaway. If you live in Georgia, you might know about the Callaway Gardens. That's been a popular summer destination for decades. The Callaway name also adorns golf equipment, golf t-shirts, golf hats sold all over the world. But the man behind that brand was Fuller E. Callaway, born in LaGrange, Georgia in 1870. And historians Buck and Carol Melton join me now to talk about him. Their new book is called Fuller E. Callaway, Portrait of a New South Citizen. Buck and Carol, hi.
Hello.
Can we first talk about what a New South citizen is? Carol, could you explain what you think of as New South?
Well, obviously, most people think of the Old South as the pre-Civil War South. The post-Civil War South was also a fairly grim place, and Henry Grady, who was a well-known newspaper editor in Atlanta, pointed out the need for the South to change economically if people were going to survive. And one of the things that he suggested was some form of industrialization. It didn't make good economic sense for cotton to be grown in the South, shipped up north, processed, made into much more expensive cloth, and then bought by Southerners who had very little money to begin with. So that was the origin of his thinking about the New South.
But Buck, was there a philosophy behind the New South that went along with the business plan, and did Callaway fit into that?
Well, yes, indeed. Fuller Calloway, I think, is one of the best representatives of the New South to come out of Georgia. The philosophy was essentially, Grady believed that the reason the South had lost the Civil War was because it got beat industrially. So it's sort of a South will rise again mentality. And the entire South bought into it. Cotton and textiles, textile manufacturing was the lead, but then, of course, it branched out into all sorts of areas.
So tell me a little bit about how Fuller Calloway got started, because it sounds like from a very young age, I mean, even as a kid, he was thinking of ways to make like a few pennies at a time. It's not like he started out with this great idea that suddenly made, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. He started out selling things like buttons, did he not?
Indeed. The traditional story is that he started out with a nickel and bought either three spools of thread with that nickel or six spools of thread, and realized in true capitalistic style that if he added a walk to those spools of thread and walked them out into the country, then he added value to that through his labor and could sell them for more. And his entrepreneurial spirit had really shown by the time he was 6 or 7 years old.
And he went on, Carol, to I guess, imitate Woolworths. When he finally was able to buy a store, what was he trying to accomplish?
Well, I don't know that he was imitating anybody particularly. The one person who he did emulate was Wanamaker's in the one price system of pricing. It used to be when you went into a store, you really did have to dicker with the clerk, and not everybody got the same price. And the idea was that if you put a fixed price on an item, people knew what they were getting, knew what it cost, and it would increase sales. And then also you could hire clerks who weren't as good at the dickering as the owner. So that was the origin of that. He invented a lot of things himself, I think, simultaneous with other entrepreneurs who were experimenting with what got people's attention, what brought people into the store. One of his things was he would try every Saturday to have something that would draw a crowd to his store.
So give me an example then of something that drew a crowd.
Well, I think one of my favorite ones is he would put a set of boots, which were relatively expensive for most people, at the top of a greased pole. And if you could climb up the greased pole, you could have the boots. Well, people generally wore their better clothing for market day. So he had next to the greased pole a table full of overalls for sale.
That's so, genius.
He was very clever. He was a great student of psychology.
And then how did that little store and that nickel full of thread, Buck, grow into him becoming an industrial, just a huge success? And he had died fairly young in his 50s, so he did all this in a pretty short period of time.
Yes, he was certainly a type A personality and burned the candle at both ends. And he would simply pour whatever his earnings were into his next project. After he had been a traveling salesman for many years during his youth, he opened his first store in LaGrange, and Carol may need to help me with the name. The name of the first store was Calloway's Famous Mammoth Department mm-hmm. Store, and he'd have a grand opening, he'd sell out, and then a grand closing, and then a month later he would do it again. And as his stores became more successful, he would drop names, and so he finally, by the time he was extremely successful, it was simply known as Calloway's.
He had two giant elephants, or maybe three, on top of the store. That in itself drew attention.
What were they made of? Do we know?
I don't actually know. In the old photographs, they're sort of white, and they look like they would be concrete, but I think that would have collapsed the roof, so it must have been
Couldn't have been paper mache.
They
would have melted. My guests are historians Carol and Buck Melton. Their new book is a biography of George's Fuller E. Calloway. And Carol, there was also an advertising gimmick that involved a mule named Maud. What was that?
Oh, good grief. He put an ad into the paper and said, he would pay, I can't remember, do you remember, $50 or something, for a white mule named Maud that he would enjoy plowing with? And this was, people came in with these white mules that they obviously changed their names because Maud became a very popular mule name in West Georgia suddenly. But he would look at them and say, well, you know, that's really a fine mule, but I just don't believe I'd enjoy plowing with that mule.
It met all other qualifications, but...
But he had put in that that I would enjoy plowing with.
But he,
and it brought... And people came from all around with these mules, and then, of course, they shopped in the store.
Yeah, but, I assume the thing was he didn't enjoy plowing.
That was the condition, that he was not met. So otherwise, he'd have had about 100 mules named Maud.
So, Buck, I found it interesting. You told one of our producers that there's actually two ways to tell the story of history, and one is the great man story, and one is the social history. What do you mean?
Well, the idea is who makes history or what makes history. Is history driven by a few individuals who make crucial decisions that push the whole thing forward? This great man theory was best popularized by Thomas Carlyle about 200 years ago. Or are the great men themselves products of vast social movements, small decisions made by the great mass of humanity? I think in reality, the two affect each other. I tend to be a great man historian simply because I'm drawn to very interesting personalities. And therefore, biography, the biography of a single individual, fits into this very well. And I think that Fuller E. Calloway is certainly a great man by using this model.
Well, I want to kind of examine or help have you guys help me examine the extents of that great man, because one of the things that surprised me is that Ida Tarbell liked him. Now, and if people don't recognize the name of Ida Tarbell, she was what's now known as a muckraker. She was perhaps our very first investigative journalist. She really did a number on Rockefeller and exposing people who made a lot of money by being jerks and abusive. But she liked Calloway. Why?
Well, it's fascinating that if 60 Minutes had existed 100 years ago, Ida Tarbell would have been the host to give you an idea of where she fits
in. She
was
no joke.
Yes. But Calloway was what is sometimes disparagingly referred to as a paternalist. He would set things up in such a way as to be of maximum benefit to his mill employees, even though that might minimize some of their freedom of action. But the idea was to attract mill workers, to keep them in the mill, to keep a stable workforce. He had to do things that they would find attractive. So he founded infirmaries. He would have greenhouses that the mill employees could use. He would engage in beautification efforts. He founded schools for the mill children. And so when Ida Tarbell showed up around 1920 to do a piece on the Calloway organization, she was absolutely enthralled. And I think that this speaks volumes about how good the Calloway organization was, because if Ida Tarbell had not liked it, she would not have written such a positive piece.
Well, I think he kind of got her at hello, because she said, "What do you do down there in LaGrange?" He said, "We make American citizens and we run the mills to pay the bills."
Oh, interesting. Carol, how did he move from textiles, for making cloth, into railroads?
Well, really, the railroads had a lot to do with his mercantile business, because they had a long-haul rate from Atlanta to New Orleans that was fairly low. But even if they took something you ordered from New Orleans off in LaGrange before it got to Atlanta, they would charge you the haul rate all the way to Atlanta plus a much higher rate to send it back to LaGrange, even if it didn't make that trip. And he was constantly aggravated with the railroads about their rate. And Buck can probably explain this a little bit in more detail, but it ended up in going to the Supreme Court of the United States. And eventually, when that didn't work out for him, he just chartered his own railroad.
Buck, did you want to go into more detail? Because he eventually served on the Railroad Commission for the state of Georgia.
Yes, that was essentially it, that between Atlanta and New Orleans, you, of course, had competition. You could travel many different ways, but from LaGrange to Atlanta, it was a monopoly, and the railroad could charge what it wanted. So finally, to get around that, Callaway was forced to found his own railroad, and in doing so, learned a great deal about how railroads worked. And so as progressivism took hold in the state of Georgia in the first decade or two of the 20th century, the Democratic progressive politicians naturally turned to Callaway to help Georgia modernize the rail system and come up with railroad regulation.
What kind of legacy does he leave behind, Carol? I mean, it's the Callaway name is all over golf golf clothing, and it's on the gardens, which he didn't found. But what kind of legacy did he leave?
Well, what he did found was, of course, the mills, which were sold eventually to Millikan. But he created his home in LaGrange, Hills and Dales Estate, which is now open to the public and celebrating its 100th anniversary.
Is that the one that looks like a villa in Italy?
Yes, that's a Neil Reed design, Henson Reed, one of their first very large commissions. And it was built on the site of an existing house that had been Farrell Plantation. And it was built to complement the existing and what I like to call the original Callaway Gardens, the Hills and Dales Estate, which was an antebellum garden built and constructed by Mrs. Farrell in the 1840s, 50s, and on, which has some very interesting religious imagery in the plantings and specimen plants.
The topiary.
The topiary gardens, and was certainly the most elaborate garden in West Georgia in the 19th century, probably. And it is from that I think Cason Callaway, the eldest son of Fuller Callaway Sr., got his love of gardening, and then he went on to found Callaway Gardens. As for the golf, that is the half-brother of Fuller Callaway's family, Ely Callaway.
I just wanted to play a little audio of Fuller Callaway Jr. Here he is, mm-hmm. Recorded in 1985, talking about his dad. It is a little difficult to hear the audio, so you'll want to listen closely.
When he died, he was head of 26 corporations that he'd started from scratch, business corporations. I'm starting from scratch, including six banks. And his secretary told me that in his entire life, he never asked for a file. He knew every sale that had been made.
Buck, there's a lot of apocryphal stories about businessmen. Do we know if this one's true?
I think that it is probably true. I tend to think when listening to Fuller Callaway Jr., as Huckleberry Finn once said of Mark Twain, that some things he stretched, but mostly he told the truth. That Fuller Callaway Sr. was a good one for a tall tale, and then Fuller Callaway Jr. would further elaborate on it. But it seems pretty clear that Fuller Callaway had a phenomenal memory, both for remembering things and also for being able to do complicated math problems in his head.
So ahead, Carol.
I was just going to add that he has the reputation for having a phenomenal memory, and I think he absolutely did. But the other thing that people don't know, and he didn't show so much, was the hours of study he put in at night. He would go over things and read things. And so when he went into a meeting, he knew everything before he asked a question. So some of that was phenomenal, a naturally good memory. Another part of that was that he worked extremely hard to be master of all information.
So that leaves me, Buck, with going back to the beginning in the New South. Did he accomplish what Grady had wanted to accomplish in terms of revamping Georgia and the South?
I believe that Fuller Callaway is one of the best representatives of being a successful New South merchant and a New South textile magnate that you can find anywhere. And it's just surprising that the biographers have largely overlooked Callaway's story until now, and it's just been a great honor for us to be able to correct the record.
Carol and Buck Melton, they are co-authors of the new book, Fuller E. Callaway, Portrait of a New South Citizen. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. you ever bragged about how smart your dog is, the pride you feel about how intelligent they can be, or how the cat always seems to know when you're a little bit down in the dumps and tries to cheer you up, maybe? Animal intelligence fascinates us, and biologists have been studying it for years, but primatologist Frans de Waals says asking if animals are as smart as we are is really the wrong question. Frans de Waals is the director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. He's also a professor at Emory University, and his new book is called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Frans de Waals, welcome.
Yeah, I'm glad to be there.
I have to admit, this book is fascinating. You almost can't put it down. And we can't go through everything point by point. But I wanted to start with this idea of this question of comparison. Because it looks as though we have, for a long time, judged animals' intellect based on whether they can accomplish things humans can. Is that accurate?
Yeah, we are very focused, of course, on language and reading and writing and technology. And we are very strong in that. And so we have tried to judge animals on those terms. And that works okay with, let's say, a chimpanzee who is very similar to us and has very similar skills. But there are species, you know, like, let's say, the octopus or the elephant or certain birds that are very smart but are very different from us and have a very different lifestyle. And why would we make that comparison? Is that really interesting to know, are you smarter than an octopus? Well, in your environment, with what you daily do, you are obviously very smart. But in the octopus's environment, who knows how you would be faring? We don't know.
And what a continuing theme throughout the book is this idea of crafting a useful experiment. One of the questions we've often asked is how well do animals use tools? That's been a measure of intelligence in the past. But you talk about one in which they didn't take into account the animal's biology, the structure of the animal's body when they were crafting the experiment. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so, for example, with the elephant, they tested elephants on mirrors to see if they recognize themselves in mirrors, but they used a very small mirror, and an elephant probably only sees a whole lot of gray moving around in a small mirror. And they tested tool use in elephants by giving them a stick and putting food outside of their cage and see what they would do. And any primate will pick up the stick and get the food closer and then eat it, of course. But the elephant was not doing anything. And they had concluded that means elephants are not tool users. But elephants have a trunk, and the trunk is not just a grasping organ, but is also a smelling organ. And it turns out the elephant doesn't want to close off that organ when he reaches for food. And so when they gave elephants boxes to stand on, even boxes that were far away that he had to bring all the way from another part of the enclosure to the place where they had hung some food very high, he would do that. And so he was able to use tools, but not the way we wanted them, so to speak. And that's always a problem with testing of animals. If you don't find something, what does that mean? Does that mean that it lacks a capacity, or does it mean that we did not do the right test on them?
So there's also a really fascinating section on testing of mice, and mice are such common lab animals. They were testing to see if mice could conceal the fact that they were in pain. How did that experiment work?
Well, there's several pain experiments. One on mice was on what we call empathy. So there's now increasingly studies on rodents and empathy. And the mouse study was to see if they exhibited pain and if that stimulated the pain sensitivity of other mice. So that was what they call pain contagion. And recently at Emory, we did a study on voles. Voles are also little rodents. And we did a neuroscience study on empathy and found that the neural circuitry, basically, the way empathy works in the rodent is exactly the same it works in the human. And so this is a very old system that you also have in your average dog. Your dog is empathic. Your dog responds to your emotions. And that's actually why we have dogs and cats in the house rather than snakes and lizards usually, because mammals have that capacity and we like that in them.
So then there was another point at which scientists threw a t-shirt that smelled of humans into the cage with the mice, and they were really afraid. And I wondered, does that mean that every experiment related to mice is in some way possibly flawed because there are humans present?
Ah, well, what they found actually is that mice perform better with female experimenters than male experimenters, and that mice are apparently a little bit stressed if they smell that there's a man around. And that may be true for other animals as well. We know it now for mice. Who knows? It may be true for other animals. And so that means that if you have experimenters of two genders, you have to watch which gender is doing the testing. And so this all relates to methodology. We in science, of course, the scientists, we are very keen on good methodology, and we need to pay attention to that. But people don't always realize that these small details, which because it seems like a small detail, matter a lot for the animals.
And it also, in terms of methodology, makes it difficult to test these things in a lab, right? As opposed to going out into the field and watching gorillas in their own natural habitat, which is something that's been discussed long before. It makes it difficult to create a lab experiment that really shows us the natural behavior of an animal.
Yeah, that's why it's very important to always combine the two. So I do, of course, my experiments, I do them in Lawrenceville here at the Yerkes Field Station. And those are captive chimpanzees that live outdoors, but we call them indoors for the experiment, basically. That's how it works. But we always need to combine that knowledge with what we know from the field. So what do chimpanzees and bonobos do in the field? How does it relate to what we observe in captivity? You need to put the two pieces of the puzzle together to get a full picture. So, for example, we do experiments on cooperation. Now, cooperation is, we set up an apparatus on which two chimps have to pull to get their food and see how good they are to cooperate in that regard. But we need to connect that with what chimps do in the field. In the field, for example, chimpanzees cooperate to hunt monkeys. Monkeys are smaller than chimpanzees, and they live high up in the trees, so very hard to catch, obviously. And so chimps need to cooperate. They need to surround them, and they need to have a task division to do that. And so we can compare what we find in captivity with what being observed in the field, and that gives us a sort of the complete picture.
So, you know, there are tests in which we have thought we found intelligence in a non-human animal. And I'm thinking particularly of, there was one African gray parrot who became the first non-human animal to ask an existential question. And that question was, what color am I? Does a test like that and a finding like that actually reveal intelligence on the part of that gray parrot?
Well, Alex the parrot is definitely very intelligent. Alex the parrot can count up things even. So they can show Alex, well, Alex died a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to say that. But they could show Alex a few small items, like little pieces of pasta, for example, and put a cup over them. So you show him three pieces, you put a cup over it. You show him two more pieces, you put a cup over it. And then you say, how many pieces? And he says five. So he cannot even look at the pieces anymore because they're covered. But he has remembers them and he can count them up. And this was a capacity that everyone said cannot be done with language, without language. And so that humans, there's always this thinking that humans solve all these problems with language. But actually, language is probably not nearly as important as we think in our thinking process. And Alex could do things that everyone had claimed, so categorization of things, like the existential question that you gave here. And he doesn't have language the way we have. Of course, he can label things, and that's why he can call out certain names and certain numbers. But he doesn't have language the way we do.
If you're just joining us, my guest is primatologist Frans de Waal. His new book is called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Language becomes a big point in your book as well, because there are animals who have learned to maybe mimic human sounds. Maybe they're not actually understanding language the way at least human language. I'm thinking of a gorilla learning sign language, for example, and how we compare that, if it's even possible or viable to compare that to, say, the language that another animal might use to warn of a predator coming or things like that. Can we compare the languages?
Well, the thing is that language is the one capacity in my whole book where I say that's probably special for humans. We've tried to teach it to animals, and we've tried to find it in their natural communication. But a symbolic system that is flexible like our language, I don't think we have found that. Now, that doesn't mean that animals don't have communication, and sometimes very complex communication. So, for example, chimpanzees and bonobos, they have facial expressions, very similar to our facial expressions. They have hand gestures. But they're animals like, let's say, the killer whales and the dolphins that have underwater sounds that are very complex. And so the natural communication system of the animals is actually where we should be looking, I think, rather than trying to impose our communication, which is language, on them and see how far they get. I think it would be much more productive to look at what they can do naturally. And it's very complex what they do. So, for example, recently there was a study on alarm calls by chimpanzees, and they had put some artificial snake in the grass to see what they would do with it. And they found that the chimpanzees would only give the alarm calls to other chimps if the other chimps did not know about the snake. So they took into account what the others know or don't know about the snake, and that is called theory of mind. And that's another capacity that for the longest time we thought was uniquely human, but now it has been found in wild chimpanzees.
So what about, say, the language of prairie dogs, which, you know, this is a very simple animal, and I imagine most people don't think of prairie dogs as being particularly intelligent as compared to a dolphin, and yet their language is extremely specific.
Yeah, well, we usually wouldn't call it language. That's a sort of colloquialism, so we call it usually communication. And they have what we call referential communication, just like some monkeys do, where they have specific calls for specific predators. So they don't only communicate to each other, watch out, there's danger, but they also tell you what danger is out there. So it is actually quite complex. And we're discovering all these things in the last 25 years. We're discovering so many new things that we did not know about animals. And my book is partly about how it came about that we are discovering all these things now. And I think it is because in the previous century, we have simplified animals far too much. We tested them mostly in little boxes, you know, the so-called Skinner boxes for rats and pigeons. So we worked with small-brained animals in small boxes, and it is much more productive to set up complex experiments where they can show their full-blown potential, and that's what we're doing at the moment.
It also feels as though one of the things that has had to happen in order to move this research forward is for us and our scientists to let go of sort of arrogant assumptions. And that mm-hmm. brings me to the chimp Ayumu, to look at a chimp that is capable of much more than we are and think, well, maybe he is smarter if we're using a different scale.
Yeah. So Ayumu can tap numbers on a touchscreen. From 1 to 9 or from 9 to 1. But the trick is, of course, the interesting part is that the numbers disappear within a few milliseconds. So you get barely, if you as a human look at the screen, you barely see the numbers and they disappear. And he has to tap the locations where the numbers used to be in the right order. And he does that. So he has a sort of flash memory that is better than human memory. As soon as this was found, people got very upset that this chimp was better than humans. And so some American scientists, they went into training to see if they could beat the chimpanzee. And they actually, they got quite far, but not far enough. And Ayumu keeps beating everyone. And I don't know why people are so upset about it, because that relates, of course, to the idea that we need to be on top with everything, every capacity. But there are so many capacities in the animal kingdom that we don't relate to at all. So, for example, a bat can catch prey in the dark, which it does with echolocation. We cannot do that. It takes an enormous amount of brain power to do this, to calculate the path of the prey and your own speed. And it's a very complex task, but we usually don't look at it because it doesn't relate to anything that we do. And so we think, well, that's probably an instinct or something. We try to downplay what the bat is doing, which is really remarkable. And this happens all the time. As soon as we are beaten by an animal, we try to beat it back, and we try to show that we are better. And if animals have capacities that are very different from ours, we sort of forget about it and we're not particularly interested in it.
So if in the past we have thought of intelligence as a ranking, kind of like the food chain where we're on the top, and if that's incorrect, then what's a better way of thinking of animal intelligence?
Well, instead of a tree or a ladder, what we have is a bush with many branches. That's the evolutionary bush, and many of these branches are specializations. And we have one specialization. We're very good at language and abstraction and technology. So we have several specializations, and then you have other animals. They have their specializations, and so each of these branches. So for example, you can find in the primate branch, you can find animals who use tools, such as ourselves or chimpanzees and so on. But you find them also in the crows. The crows are birds. It's quite a separate branch. branch from ours, but the crows are very good tool users, and they are being tested massively at the moment in laboratories. And so you have to look at it not as a ladder, like it goes from high to low. That's what people usually do, who is the smartest of them all, and it has to be us, of course. But more like a bush with a lot of specializations.
So we have about a minute left. Can we answer, or can you answer the title of your book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are?
Well, I'm an optimist. I think we are smart enough for the task, and we are working very hard on it. But of course, the answer is that in the previous century, we didn't show that kind of intelligence. We tested animals in very simplistic ways, and we had very simplistic views about how they were instinctive or simple learners. We didn't really appreciate the intelligence of animals.
So the answer has been no, we weren't smart enough, but it's possible that we are.
Yeah, the new generation, I think, is, yeah.
Frans de Waal is the director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. He also teaches at Emory University. His new book is called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? And I guess the answer is maybe. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Okay, thank you.
That's our show for today. But tell me about your smart pet. How intelligent is your dog, lizard, cat, bird? And what do they do that actually makes you think they're really smart? We would also love video. Look, if there's no pictures, you can't prove it. So send us some video. Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us at OST Talk or post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. Look, if your pet is dumb, we'll hear about that too. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.